Good morning again. Welcome, especially if you're joining us for the first time. We're thrilled you're here. Also, welcome to folks who are watching on Facebook Live. It is the third week of Advent. Is it going by too quick for anybody else? Has anybody else had that experience? Anybody? Anybody? Okay. How many of you, next Sunday, we're having ugly sweater day, unless you're Jessica White and you thought it was today and you wore yours, which is fine. You do you, girl. That's not... So how many of you are wearing an ugly sweater next week? Can I get a show of hands? Okay. The rest of you, why do you hate Christmas and the baby Jesus? Oh, my goodness. Why are you being Grinches? Everybody should do this next week. I just want to go ahead and throw down the gauntlet, and I want to tell you, I've got perhaps the greatest ugly sweater in the history of ugly sweaters, and I'm going to be wearing it next week, and you're probably not going to be listening to a word I say because of it, and I don't even care. It is that good. So hopefully next week we'll get into the Christmas spirit together. There are also these cards out at the Connection Point, these business cards, and you can use these to invite people to our Christmas Eve service. Christmas Eve will be our weekly service that week. We're moving Sunday to Saturday night for Christmas Eve. and we won't be meeting on the 25th on Sunday morning. So if you would like to invite somebody, this is a great way to do that. And then finally, one more thing we didn't mention earlier, our kids who are doing the Christmas play next Sunday night, they have rehearsal today at 3:30. So if your child's in the Christmas play, if you could make sure they're here at 3:30, they're going to be going through that and getting ready to put that on next week for us. So here we are, the third week of Advent, the week of joy. We lit the rose-colored candle. The Donaldsons lit the rose-colored candle. Can I tell you the amount of nerves I had giving Cody Donaldson a microphone? You have no idea, but they were fantastic. They were fantastic. So we're going to talk a bit today about joy. We began with hope, and the hope candle is burning kind of low. So if it catches that wreath on fire, I need somebody to yell, okay, because that's going to be a problem. But the hope candle, we began with hope, and we talked about, we have this hope that God will work in, with, and through anybody who's willing to participate in what God's doing in the world. That God will work in, with, and through any human being who's willing to say yes to God's work in the world. Then we moved to peace, and last week we talked about we can't really go around talking about peace on earth if we're not willing to become instruments of that peace in the world. And then we moved to joy. And I have to tell you, joy probably for lots of us in this room, and I'm just going on the stories I've heard from people, my own experiences of 2016, this has been a really hard year. And it seems like in some ways, talking about joy when so much has happened in our world and so much has happened in our own lives, that it seems really hard to talk about joy. So I thought we should begin with a clip that would really set us up nicely to talk about this. Now, I have to tell you, last year I was a total Grinch. This year, I am nauseatingly in the Christmas spirit. And I've been watching Christmas movies since Thanksgiving. Maybe before, but I would never admit that publicly. I love Christmas movies. Some of my favorite Christmas movies, one of them is the movie Die Hard. Any Die Hard fans? It is a Christmas movie. If you disagree, you're just wrong. It is a Christmas movie. Cohen and I watched The Grinch a couple of nights ago, the live-action Grinch with Jim Carrey. That's great. But perhaps the greatest Christmas movie, or maybe greatest movie of all time, has to be National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. Yes. We found some common ground. And there's this scene where I'm going to show you when they're out in the front yard, and Clark Griswold, who I just identify with so much in life, he is about to light the Christmas lights on their house for the very first time. So let's check this out.
Hurry this up, Clark. I'm freezing my baguettes off. 250 strands of lights, 100 individual bulbs per strand for a grand total of 25,000 imported Italian twinkle lights. Hey! 25,000.
Well, I hope nobody I know drives by and sees me standing in the yard staring at the house in my pajamas.
If they know your dad, they won't think anything of it.
Fire it up, Dad!
I dedicate this house to the Griswold family Christmas.
Oh.
Drum roll, please. Drum roll.
Beautiful, Clark.
Oh. isn't that great? Isn't that great? You know, I think there's something to that, this moment where all this anticipation is built up, the drum roll is going on, and he hits the button, and nothing happens. Joy to the world, but then everything falls flat. That seems like an experience of life that we've become quite familiar with, isn't it? We sort of come in moments like this, and we talk about joy, and we put on sort of this happy person facade, and but the real story is lots of us don't have joy. Lots of us struggle. Lots of us are hurting. Lots of us are wounded. Lots of us are in rough relationships. Lots of us have financial worries. Lots of us have all sorts of things going on. And so it's a bit like singing Joy to the World and waiting for that big moment where all the lights come on and nothing happens. And I think in some ways we sentimentalize the Christmas story to a point where think about I love Christmas songs, I love Christmas carols, but think about, we talk about Silent Night and this idea of this mom holding her brand new baby and everything's just right. and we haven't really thought about it. It probably was not a silent night. I mean, childbirth is not a quiet thing, right? And on top of that, you have a pregnant preteen peasant girl who's about to give birth. I bet there wasn't a baby shower. In her culture, in her world, I bet there was lots of shame. There was lots of people asking questions. There were lots of people wondering what's exactly going on here. And so we sentimentalize this moment, and we don't realize this was probably one of the most difficult moments of this young girl's life. I mean, Mary was probably somewhere around 12 or 13. That was when girls got married in that culture. Their fathers would essentially trade them for some chickens and goats or something to their husband. And this was how the world worked then. So before we talk about joy, and I want to look at a song that this young girl Mary sings in the Gospel of Luke. But before we do that, we need a bit of context. And there's an author named John Dominic Crossan. He wrote this book. It came out in the early 90s called Jesus, A Revolutionary Biography. And he talks about what the world was like when Jesus was born. And I want to read you just, this is kind of a lengthy section, but for us to understand Mary's song we're going to read in a bit, we have to understand what the world was like. The Roman Empire was an agrarian society, right? So farms, wheat, all that sort of stuff. Characterized by the forging of iron plows, the harnessing of animal traction, the use of the wheel and sail to move goods. It was also characterized by an abysmal gulf separating the upper from the lower classes. On the one side of the Great Divide were the ruler and the governors, who together made up 1% of the population but owned at least half of the land. All right, so this has no connection to our world at all, right? The 1% owning, so they owned half the land. Think about this. Also, on that same side were three other classes, the priests, so the religious leaders, who could own as much as 15% of the land, the retainers, ranging from military generals to expert bureaucrats, and the merchants, who probably evolved upward from the lower classes, but who could end up with considerable wealth and even some political power as well. So right now you have 50, 60, 65% of the land is owned by this 1%. On the other side above all the peasants. That was the vast majority of the population, about two-thirds of whose annual crop went to support the upper class. If they were lucky, they lived at subsistence level, barely able to support family, animals, and social obligations, and still have enough for the next year's seed supply. If they were not lucky, drought, debt, disease, or death forced them off their own land and into sharecropping, tenant farming, or worse. Next came the artisans, about 5% of the population, below the peasants and social class because they were usually recruited and replenished from its dispossessed members. Beneath them were the degraded and the expendable class, the former with origins, occupations, or conditions rendering them outcasts. The latter may be as much as 10% of the population, ranging from beggars and outlaws to hustlers, day laborers, and slaves. Those expendables existed, as that terrible title suggests, because despite mortality and disease, war and famine, agrarian societies usually contained far more of the lower classes than the upper classes found it profitable to employ. Expendables were, in other words, a systemic necessity. If Jesus was a carpenter, therefore, he belonged to the artisan class, that group pushed into the dangerous space between peasants and degradeds or expendables. So if you want an image of what it was like in Jesus' world, the best way to think of this, and don't let me hit anybody here, I feel like I'm on the WWE right now. You know what I mean? If you think about Jesus' world, and you think about it in terms of a ladder, there were a group of people at the top, and this was roughly 1% of the population who owned roughly 65% of the land. And the other two-thirds were at the bottom. At the top, wealth, power, privilege. More than enough food to eat, really, really nice homes, really, really fancy accoutrements in their homes. We talked last week about how King Herod had heated pools in his house. We talked about bottles of wine that have been uncovered that would have fetched somewhere around, in modern equivalency, about $20,000 per bottle found in Jerusalem after the Roman destruction. So you have this society set up that works really, really well for the people at the top. But this working really, really well for the people at the top depends on who? The production of the people at the bottom. And the people at the bottom, like Jesus' family, wouldn't have even been at the bottom. The ladder would have been sitting on top of them. Right? Joseph was a carpenter, which means more like a mason than actual woodworker. He was an artisan. He was somebody who wasn't working land, which means he had no family land, which means he was dispossessed, which means he was trying to feed his family. Every day he would go to work, get enough money for that day, maybe, to pay all of his taxes, to give what he needed to Caesar, to give what he needed to Herod, to give what he needed to the temple. And then whatever was left, his family would live on. Jesus grew up in poverty. Maybe that's actually too nice of a way to put it. Jesus grew up where if poverty's here, Jesus grew up here. Right? The ladder is literally sitting on these people. And so when we come to the Christmas story in the Gospel of Luke, it's a really strange story. It begins, by the way, not with Jesus' birth, but with the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth. Zechariah is a priest, and he and his wife Elizabeth, the text says, are very old. And they've been unable to have children. And one day when Zechariah is doing his priestly duty, an angel named Gabriel appears and says, Zechariah, God's heard your prayers. You're going to have a baby. Your wife Elizabeth is going to get pregnant. You're going to have a baby. And of course he responds with, I'm not sure you know how this works. We are way too old to have a baby. This is not going to happen. And the angel says, he says, how will I know? And the angel says, it's going to happen. You're going to have a baby. His name's going to be John. And this baby is going to essentially invite the people to repent and prepare them for the coming of God. And here's how you're going to know this is going to happen. You're not going to say another word until the baby's born. And so Zechariah comes back out and he can't speak and he's making all these gestures trying to tell people what happened. Sure enough, his wife Elizabeth in her old age got pregnant. There's an echo here of Abraham and Sarah, by the way. You know the story of Abraham and Sarah? I mean, the wink, wink, nudge, nudge. This story's about that story. And then after Zechariah and Elizabeth have their encounter with the angel, an angel appears to a young girl named Mary. Unmarried virgin girl named Mary. And says to Mary, you're going to have a baby. This baby's going to be the Son of God. This baby's going to inhabit the throne of his father David. This baby's going to change the world. And Mary asks, how is this going to happen? Because I've never been with a man. And when Zechariah asked this, the angel made him not able to talk. When Mary asked, he goes, oh, it's okay. Your cousin Elizabeth's pregnant. Just trust God. Nothing's impossible with God. So Mary goes to visit Elizabeth. And when she enters the house, she gives a greeting. And the baby in Elizabeth's womb, who would become John the Baptizer, this baby leaps for joy at the sound of Mary's greeting. And then Mary, after her discussion with Elizabeth, sings this song. Now, I want you to try to understand this. When we hear the Christmas story, we hear it the way we do because globally, we are up here. Are you with me? I know you may not feel like it. I know you may not feel like it, but you're up here. This was back in the early 2000s. I read the statistic that if an average college student makes $11,000 a year, and they're in the top 3% globally. So, understand, if you live in America, there's a really good chance, no matter how much money you make, that you're up here. And when people up here, like you and I, hear the Christmas story, or any story, we have to filter. We filter in such a way that it makes us feel really okay about being up here, and we lose some of the power of it. So I'm going to ask you today, if possible, and I've been trying to do this as I've been reading this story through Advent, I'm going to ask you to join me and try not to hear this as somebody at the top of the ladder. I want you to try to hear it as somebody that the ladder is sitting on. And maybe imagine how somebody at the top of the ladder, if they really hear what this young girl's saying, imagine how they would feel about it. Are you with me? So here's Mary's song. It's called the Magnificat. Just to give you a bit of, it's a Latin word that means, the first line essentially, my soul magnifies the Lord. In the Byzantine tradition, they call this the Ode to Theotokos. Theotokos means mother of God, God bearer. And so this is the song Mary sings. And here's how it goes. Mary said, with all my heart, I glorify the Lord. In the depths of who I am, I rejoice in God my Savior. He has looked with favor on the low status of his servant. Look, from now on, everyone will consider me highly favored because the Mighty One has done great things for me. Holy is his name. He shows mercy to everyone from generation to the next who honors him as God. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered those with arrogant thoughts and proud inclinations. He has pulled the powerful down from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty-handed. He has come to the aid of his servant Israel, remembering his mercy, just as he promised to our ancestors, to Abraham and to Abraham's descendants forever. Now, if you hear this story sitting at the top and you try to make it make sense to you, it's not going to. If you sing it from the bottom of the ladder, how does this make a person at the top? If you're King Herod, how does this song make you feel? Right? You're not looking for the MP3 download of this one. You're wanting to stop this song. Do you remember last week we looked at the story of the Magi in Matthew's gospel, and it said that when Herod heard the message of the Magi, he was troubled and all Jerusalem with him? Right? When the people at the top of the ladder hear somebody at the bottom or underneath the ladder saying, God hasn't forgotten us. God is going to pull the powerful off of their thrones. God is going to send the rich away empty-handed, and God is going to take care of us. How does this make you feel? Right? I mean, the idea is, if the story of Jesus really is just about evacuating earth for heaven, then nobody sings songs like this. This is a girl who has grown up in an upside-down world, and her insistence is that God is about to flip the upside-down world right side up again. That vast empires have been built on the backs and at the expense of the bottom of the ladder, which is a vast amount of people, and the 1% at the top have actually gotten away with immorality and pretty much murder, if you want to be honest about it. Think about these words. He has pulled the powerful down from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty-handed. Now, and this may be a total first world, me trying to rationalize something here. I don't think what this text is saying is that if you happen to be a person of wealth, that you're a bad person. I don't think that's what the text is saying. In the Gospels, Jesus actually was taking, his ministry was supported by some wealthy women who believed in what he was doing. I think what this text is saying is that there's this tendency among people who end up at this part of the ladder, at the top. There's this tendency of them to want to slant everything in their favor. There's this tendency among those of us who have been really, really fortunate to grow up where we've grown up, with the benefits we've grown up with the opportunities we've grown up with. There's this tendency for us to always want to stack the deck in our favor. And when we start supporting this 1% on the backs and at the expense of the lower part of the ladder, that's immoral. This is what this story is saying. If Herod had a ton of money and he used it to help the poor, and he rethought his policies and stopped taking 2/3 of the production away from the lower class, like if he thought about, gosh, I need to live in a way that's sustainable for everybody, and I've got wealth, which means I need to use my wealth and creativity to make sure everybody's got enough food to eat. Are you with me? Like, that's a good sort of thing. I hope there are people in the world with a ton of money who want to use it for the betterment of the whole wide world. Don't you? So that everybody has enough? And there are people in the world who do that. But the tendency of the 1% is to slant everything in favor of the 1%. And this girl stands up in a culture where women weren't highly valued as they are in our day and should be. And she essentially said, this is not the song of a preteen pregnant peasant girl, is it? This is a song. This is bold. This is challenging. This girl is essentially putting her finger in the chest of Herod and says, you are going down. She's putting her finger in the face of Caesar and saying, you're not it. Somebody bigger, somebody better is coming. And the one who's coming is going to take this upside down world and flip it right side up again. And those who don't have are going to have. Jesus told this in stories all the time. The last will become what? First. The first will become what? Last. If you go shopping on Black Friday, that'd be a brilliant thing, wouldn't it? Like, you just show up at, like, you know, whenever, and you get to go in first. This is what Jesus is saying. The people who have now, he actually says in the Beatitudes in the Gospel of Luke, blessed are the poor, woe to the rich. Again, I don't think he's saying woe to the rich who are using their goods and resources to help the world. I think he's saying woe to those who have at the expense of others and are trying to find new and creative ways to keep having at the expense of others. This song, if it doesn't make you uncomfortable as a Western American in the wealthiest empire and wealthiest society probably the world has ever known, if this song doesn't make you uncomfortable, you haven't heard it correctly. This song says to us, if we do not use our resources for the benefit of those who have none, then we actually aren't on God's side. And it also says something about how the world's going to get fixed. You may ask this question, how would God repair the world? You would think it would come from the king's palace, right? That God would go to the upper crust and all their creativity and all their education and all their wealth and all their resources and say to them, we've got to fix the world, and you folks are the people I want to start with. The powerful, the elite, the people of influence, right? Like if God were going to convene a meeting, he would invite Warren Buffett and T. Boone Pickens and Bill Gates, right? That they like, how are we going to fix the world? Where does God go to announce that everything is about to change? To whom does he speak? To a young, preteen, peasant girl. Maybe think about it like this. Advent reminds us that God's work to change the world is never top down, but always bottom up. When God wants to fix the world, God doesn't go to the top of the ladder and say, okay, now we got to figure out what to do. God comes to those who the ladder is sitting on and says, do you want to change things, not only for yourself, but for every single human being? Do you want to get in on what I'm going to do in the world? And maybe that's brilliant, because I bet the people at the top would have lots of ideas how to make the world better. Well, we just got to figure out how to get more blood out of that turnip down there. That's how you make the world better, because the world for them is them. But when you come to somebody at the bottom who has nothing, they don't know if they're going to eat today, and you ask them, do you want to partner with me to change history? They get up and they write songs like this, and they shake their fist at power, and they demand something to change. Christmas is a reminder that ultimately God doesn't need us to figure everything out. God needs people who are willing to join in the work God's already doing in the world. So what does this mean for us? This is always the question we come to. What is this? It's hard for us as we're not in Mary's spot, no matter how much we want to pretend like we are. We're just not in Mary's spot. We're the wealthy. We're the 1%. What do we do with a story like this? How do we respond? And I would just offer a few things. Perhaps I'll offer a few things. Oh, I turned it off. There we go. First, I would say this. God isn't looking for people who have it all together. God is looking for you and me. God isn't looking for people who have it all together. When I meet somebody who has it all together, I automatically assume that person is lying. Right? Do you do this? Like when you see somebody who just seems to be so put together, you're like, I bet they go home and just cry. Like, there's no way you can be that put together. That takes way too much effort. God isn't looking for people who have it all together. God isn't looking for the most morally pure. God isn't looking for the people who know the Bible the best. God isn't looking for people who can judge everybody else because they're so, you know, pure as the driven snow. God is just looking for people who are willing to join God. And those are people just like you and me. And yes, you and I are part of the 1%. No way of getting around it in the world. Globally, we are part of the 1%. Can you imagine if a group of 1%ers said to this story, said to God, yes, we will use our 1%-ness to join you in making the world a better place. We've got a voice, and we've got some resources, and we've got some energy, and we've got some creativity, and we are going to leverage that on behalf of the people who need it most. Can you imagine what would happen if we just really came to trust that God isn't looking for people who have it all together? Right? There's something about it when God sends a messenger to somebody in the Bible, they always kind of have this who me moment. Do you ever have that moment? Where you have the sense of perhaps you're being drawn to care for somebody, you're drawn to give a gift to somebody, you're drawn to say hello to somebody, you're drawn to give a hug to somebody, whatever that looks like for you, you just feel this sort of impulse. Do you ever go like, who am I? Who am I to do that? And the who am I's of the world are the exact people God has been looking for. If there's not that sort of response, then I'm not sure we understand what's happening. You and I are being invited to actually be a part of changing the world, not just for our benefit. And I've actually found that if you actually say yes to this, your life may not be as easy and cushy as it used to be. Are you with me? Saying yes to this sort of invitation means that your life will become much more complicated. There, you'll be people in your life who make your life more complicated. There'll be decisions you have to make about how you spend your money, how you spend your time, what you do with your life that used to be pretty cut and dry and simple that now become really, really complicated. When people say that following Jesus is the easiest decision they've ever made, I just automatically, again, assume they haven't really done it. Because following Jesus, you may have prayed a prayer, you may have joined a church. Following Jesus is a radical, radical transformation, ongoing transformation that demands we live differently. So second, I would say this. We are only on God's side when we are on the side of the poor. Period. Right? And the question isn't so much, we want God on our side, right? We want God on our side. That's not really the question. The question isn't, does God join us? The question is, do we join God? Right? If we're going to be on God's side, then that automatically looks like caring for the poor. I mean, if you read the Bible, it's all over it. Whose cry does God hear? The Israelites in slavery. And this launches what the scriptures talk about as redemption history. God rescuing and liberating slaves. And throughout the Bible, read the teaching of Jesus. Read the teaching of Jesus. Jesus is saying God cares about the poor, the outcast, and the expendable. Those, the vulnerable and those on the margins. The people the 1% have victimized to become. These are the people God is for. And we are only on God's side when we're people who actually care about the poor, because that's where God's heart is. And I got to tell you, Protestants, we sort of have this cocky thing about us. Catholics have been doing this much better than we have for a long, long, long time. And there's a pope right now who's doing good work trying to raise awareness that the poor exist, that they are God's beloved, and we have been called to care for them. So let me just give you a few. I love statistics at times. Let me give you a few statistics. I read this one on Twitter the other day. The top 10 pharmaceutical executives received over $327 million last year. If I were counting in $1 bills, I could never make it there. Like, that's a lot of money, right? While 1 in 5 Americans can't afford to fill their prescriptions. We have a word for this. It's immoral. It's immoral. That people who come up with these, what could potentially be life-saving drugs, are getting filthy, stinking rich, and 1 in 5 Americans can't afford to buy those drugs. That's immoral. It's not immoral that they have wealth. It's immoral how they're getting it. It's coming at a cost, and that cost is human life. That cost is human flourishing. I read this one yesterday. 40% of the food in the U.S. is wasted. I actually read this interesting article about this guy who, in the past 2 years combined, he spent $5.50 on food. And he's basically dumpster diner, I think is what they're calling him. And what he does is he goes to like supermarkets and places where every day they throw stuff out. And he says he eats really well. He takes, sometimes they don't even throw it in the dumpster. They just like have it ready for him. He gets vegetables and meat and all the stuff he needs. And he takes it home and he cooks it. And he's spent $5.50 on food in 2 years' time because Americans waste 40% of our food. We just throw it out. $165 billion a year. Of food is wasted. 1 in 6 people in the U.S. are food insecure, which is a way of saying they don't know where their next meal is coming from. We have a word for this. It's immoral. That people are starving to death. Not just people around the world. That's immoral too. That we're letting people around the world starve to death when there's plenty to go around. It's even more immoral. We have people in our own communities who are starving to death. They don't have enough food. They have to choose between them and their kids eating. Not okay. When we're wasting 40% of our food. Does that anger you at all? And these aren't just numbers. These are real, living, breathing human beings. Right? We're having this coffee house to raise money for Bloodwater tonight. And they're doing such good work around the world. I wanted to share a bit about what they're doing. More than 650 million people in the world don't have access to safe water. That's 1 in 10. So if we went off and numbered ourselves 1 to 10, there'd be 1 in 10 of us who globally would not have access to clean water. And sometimes in the morning before I get in the shower, I turn it on a little ahead of time so it's just the right temperature because I don't want to be too cold and I don't want to be too hot. How many of you know exactly what I'm talking about? Yeah. 1 in 10 people There's 650 million people who don't have access to safe water. 2.4 billion people don't have access to adequate sanitation. Which means where it goes into our sewers or our septic tanks, and the only time we have to deal with it is when the septic tank's full, and then it's everybody's problem. We're talking human waste running down the streets, which then creates another sort of disease pathogen problem because all this waste, animal and human waste, is just everywhere, and this is creating illnesses in people that are really, really preventable if they had adequate sanitation. Almost 315,000 children under 5 die every year from diarrheal diseases caused by dirty water. Is that preventable? Yes. Yeah. And Bloodwater, who we're partnering with tonight at this coffee house, why you should all come and be a part of it, they're actually making real measurable difference in places like Africa where this sort of thing is happening all the time, but it's starting to happen less. And this is the point of our fundraiser tonight with Bloodwater. $40 is all it takes to provide one person in Africa with clean water, sanitation, and hygiene for life. One donation of $40 gets a human being clean water, sanitation, and hygiene for life. Like, it's the right thing to do. $200 would take care of a family of 5. How many of you, anybody here have a family of 5? Anybody? Can you imagine $200 and you've taken care of water, sanitation, and hygiene for your family? Forever. Forever. I run out of deodorant. Like, I don't know how they're going to do that, but $40 a person. It's not that much money when you think about it in the scheme of things. We're talking about for life. Somebody is being given a fresh start. And then I would say this, joy is bigger and more resilient than we've ever imagined. And I learned this probably, I've learned it in a couple ways. I learned it as a pastor being with people who have experienced great tragedy, great hurt, great loss, significant suffering. And yet somehow, somewhere in them, joy refuses to go away. I've seen that. I've seen it probably countless times at this point. And I've also seen it in places like The Hole in the Dominican Republic, where sewage runs down the streets, where there's a river of sewage running through the community, which is built on essentially what was a land dump until people started squatting on it. And I've heard them sing. Y'all, they put us to shame in our temperature-controlled, nice environment where we have coffee and pastries, and they put us to shame. I remember walking into the church in Conca for the first time, and we were like down the street, and we're walking to the church, and it's like all they had was like drums, but man, they are beating the snot out of those things, and people are singing and celebrating, and at the end, they all share some little snack with each other, because for some people, that's all they're going to get that day, and their joy was palpable. And the reality is, joy is one of the strongest and most resilient and powerful things we have access to. Because if we refuse to give that away, then no matter what they do to us, whoever they are, they can't touch us. We often think in terms of our own lives, and of course that's a natural human instinct, right? I want to take care of my family. I do. If you mess with my family, it's be like getting between a mama bear and her cubs or me and my coffee. Like, it's not going to go well for you. But the reality is, we have to learn to think bigger. We have to realize that our joy can't really be complete when there's so much suffering in the world. That it's not enough just to think about it and pray about it and really, you know, God, I hope you help those people out there, wherever they are. It's only enough when we actually engage and do something about it. Frederick Buechner is a writer who I love, and I want to end with this quote from him. Compassion is sometimes the fatal capacity for feeling what it is like to live inside somebody else's skin. It is the knowledge that there can never really be any peace and joy for me until there is peace and joy finally for you too. And this Christmas, I bet we're going to have a lot of joy. Most of us, I bet we're going to have a lot of joy in our homes with our families and wrapping paper everywhere and candy canes and all the whatever you guys do at Christmas. Like, it's all going to happen, and we're going to feel really good about it. And that's great. We should enjoy our families. Yes. But we also should acknowledge that while we're celebrating and enjoying, there are people in the world who are dying of things that people shouldn't die of. And that we can hold both of these things. We can hold our lives and our joy. And yet we can also realize our responsibility to help bring joy to the world. Joy to the world. Not just our slice of it. And we can actually start doing that together as a church tonight at 6 p.m. at the coffee house. You can come and you can give whatever you can give. If that's $5, $10, $40, $1 million, like whatever you can give. If you're holding back $1 million, we need to talk. But anyway, that's a whole other discussion. We can actually begin to make measurable change. We can be the people who are up here. But see, and not just go around talking about how blessed we are. We can also go around talking about how responsible we are. Because whether you want to own it or not, if there's a 1%, somebody's holding up that ladder, period. And in our own history, that's been a lot of people, right? It's been Native Americans. It's been slaves. It's been a lot of people who made this 1% possible. And we now have a responsibility to not just hoard everything at the top for ourselves. We have a responsibility to bring people with us, to make sure the world is loved and cared for, that people aren't dying of ridiculous things that people ought not die of in 2016. Are you with me? And when you're engaged in that, you can hear Mary's song, and it doesn't intimidate you. It emboldens you to keep being the hands and feet of Jesus in the world. But if you're not and you hear Mary's song, it ought to make you squirm. Because God is not on your side. When you are not on the side of the poor, God is not on your side. When you're on the side of the poor, then you're on God's side. And then everything is possible. Are you with me? Let's pray. God, for this courage and this boldness of this pregnant preteen peasant girl, the first century, who dared to sing these words. Words that challenge our comfort, words that challenge our wealth, words that challenge how we spend our time and our energy and our money. We are grateful. For this young girl who says yes to bringing this promised one into the world, we are grateful. And though virtually all of us sit at the top of this ladder, may we leave this place emboldened with a new responsibility, understanding that we have been called to love, care for, and assist, to be the hands and feet of Jesus, those on whom the ladder is sitting. Because there's never really peace and joy for us until there's peace and joy for the whole wide world. Give us that vision, we pray. We ask this in Jesus' name. And everybody said, let's stand together. Tonight at 6 p.m., I know Hudost, Wade and Moksha will be singing. I know Cody Wagner is going to be singing. There'll be some other people, maybe too. If you want to sing, I don't know what to tell you, but you can try. I don't know what your talent level is. And then don't forget next week, we have ugly Christmas sweaters. We have Christmas plays. There's Christmas rehearsal today at 3:30. Wear an ugly sweater next week, because if you don't, I'm going to assume whatever you're wearing is your ugly sweater. So you can't be offended by anything I say. So tonight, 6 p.m., show up. If you got $40, bring it. If you got $5, if you got a roll of pennies, bring it. And we'll make some real difference in the world. Grace and peace be with you.